so glad you're here. Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Ballou, and this is Rape the Podcast. Before I talk with Springfield Police Chief Paul Williams, I want to play you a phone call I had with Janice Thompson, who I talked with earlier in the podcast. She's a survivor of domestic violence like no other, and she has an incredible Facebook group that you can join, and it's called Surviving Domestic Violence in Missouri. If you do a search for that in Facebook, she posts the most amazing, well-thought-out post in reaction to different stories that come up in our news and in our community. She's very prolific, and I wanted to check in with her to see what she thinks about how things are going during COVID.
Why do you know the reasons that domestic violence has increased?
Well, and I was thinking about this, and you know, I want to preface it with, I think that saying domestic violence has increased is maybe not quite as clear as it should be. I think what's happened more than anything is it's not that COVID is causing domestic violence or that the shutdowns are causing domestic violence. The violence was there before. There was just more opportunity to leave. So we've narrowed that path that was already too narrow for escape before. Maybe before, when the abuser went to work, the victim had opportunity to pack bags and escape, or they had time for family to come in, help them, talk to them about some of the problems that they were seeing and give them resources, or the children were in school. So it gave the victim time to kind of assess what was going on, or even financially, the victim had a job and was able to save funds. You know, I hear about the increasing and all of this, and I think to myself, I feel like we're missing a vital piece of information here for the people that maybe don't understand domestic violence. We're missing the fact that maybe the abuse was there before. We're becoming too focused on abuse only being physical, and we're forgetting that there are other factors involved, like the financial and the emotional. And I will see if I can find the article I read and send it to you. There was a study done on radiology that they were seeing an increase in broken bones and injuries post-shutdowns. And I can see where maybe severity and intensity of injury is increasing because there's no break. The same thing with child abuse. There's no break. And because I always believe that abusers are very conscious of what they're doing. This is not a snap. This is not a, oh, I was drinking too much, I don't remember. This is a conscious decision. And I think that we've taken away that, well, somebody's going to see them tomorrow. So maybe now they lay into more punches, or the intensity of injury is greater because they know nobody's going to see the victim.
Are you afraid that the violence centers, the victims advocates being strapped for resources right now might also have something to do with it?
Oh, absolutely. Gosh, I hate that here we are. We were already not getting the funding that we needed. This was an epidemic before the pandemic. And it was already a struggle to get attention and funding. A good portion of the people that work for Harmony House or the Victim Center, their job is writing for grants and, you know, trying to find ways to raise money. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, those fundraisers that they were having, and those are all off. And it's just up to social media, basically, to get the word out.
Exactly. And in a world where we were already struggling to have enough resources to help victims, here we are, we suddenly had even more taken away because now maybe the business that was donating regularly every month, every year, however, you know, they chose, doesn't have the money to do that anymore.
And I feel like I've asked this question before, but it's worth repeating a million times. What can we do for our friends and for ourselves if we're in fear of continuously living with our abusers?
You know, for a friend, if you have a friend that you're concerned about, educate yourself. I would say that is probably the number one thing that I would stress. And I know for myself, it's really what saved me is having a friend that understood the situation and did not allow me to be isolated and knew what resources to point to, what avenues I should go down. So while it may not be safe for a friend to go over to their friend's house, show up, bang on the door and say, I know you're beating, you know, that's the worst thing that you could possibly do. But having resources and knowledge as to, you know, this is what you need to do. If you want to go to Harmony House, I will hold your records and information. I tell this to family members a lot. If you see your loved one and they have injuries, document it, you know, make a note, things like that to help build that information later, because sometimes that kind of thing comes in handy to have somebody else say, hey, look, I saw so-and-so with black eyes or with bruises on their wrists. See if you can find ways to get them out of the house through a doctor's appointment or what have you. Go to the doctor with them if they're injured. But for individuals, if you're stuck at home, we have our 417-864-SAFE that you can call. It can be anonymous, reaching out to the Victim Center or Harmony House, and you can find information anonymously. There are websites that if you click on escape website, it'll take you to a news center. And let's say your abuser is monitoring your phone and they're looking over your shoulder, then that it just pops up like a local news story. It won't be anything related. So
that's really clever.
And that's on, if you go to Harmony House's website, you'll see it says escape website and it's a red button. I believe it's in the top upper right and you press it and it'll just take you to a generic news station.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. So, you know, for victims right now, gosh, it is so hard. And not to be afraid to call 911. We're calling 911 right now for mask violations. If you're scared, you know, you can call 911. I know that as a victim myself, there were times that I thought, well, is this really 911 worthy? Because it's not like I'm bleeding. You know, understanding that you can use it, you can call 911 and say, I need help, or they can connect you to other resources if you need to.
Yeah, and there's maybe a record. Is that a concern of your call?
Well, if you want to make a report, that's a great, you know, say, hey, I need to make a report. You can absolutely do that. Now, as far as getting, you know, if you made a call for help, but you didn't make a report, I don't know that you would necessarily have a very good record that you could reference. But, you know, if you have an officer that comes out and speaks to you and you say, hey, I want to make a report, then yeah, you're building a record.
One last thing, because this, I think, bothered you as well last week when the Greene County Police Department's lobby had to shut for just a few days, or it may have only been one day.
Yeah.
You found that if that happens again, because I can see it happening again, what do they do instead?
Well, that was Springfield Police Department. Their lobby did close. And that was one of the first questions I asked. They said, hey, what if somebody needs to come in and do an ex parte order? You know, what are we going to do? And Greene County Jail is always open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you need to turn in paperwork for an ex parte or get paperwork for an ex parte, they are there 24/7. And if you're in danger and you're at the police station, call 911 and say, hey, I'm right out there. If there's something like that, they're concerned with you. The police are still available. Not that they won't be. It's just that they couldn't have people in the lobby. But Greene County, the Greene County Jail always will accept those ex parte requests. And then we've, of course, got Family Justice Center Monday through Friday.
Right.
The Victim Center, Harmony House, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call the 864-SAFE.
Yes, get help. Well, Janice, we are so lucky to have you in our community, and I am so blessed to even have gotten to know you over the last however many months. And so I just really appreciate everything you've done for the podcast and for everything you do for everybody. So make sure you do stuff for yourself too.
I do. And thank you so much. I love your heart for this community and for finding answers for victims. This is not something that anybody takes on lightly. nor it's not a light commitment what you're doing. And it is, you know, you have fought to get those interviews. And I really, you know, I commend you because, good Lord, I know how easy there are days that you could just say, you know what, I'm done. What's the point?
And I almost did it a few times.
Yes. I think I've done those a few times myself. So we'll keep fighting and hopefully some good things will happen.
After last week's episode, I hope you can see how this community project really does involve us. Every single one of us, no matter where you live, whether it's Springfield or anywhere else in the world. I think we need to revisit the Springfield Sexual Assault Task Force recommendations real quick. We talked about them in an earlier episode. Let's quickly revisit what we need to work on. One, they're going to appoint a team to collect data from the community about attitudes and norms regarding sexual assault and sexual violence. Number two, then they're going to educate the community and do an awareness campaign. Number three, they're creating a joint Springfield-Greene County sexual violence court, similar to a drug court, which would streamline the process. Number four, explore potential funding resources for additional victim advocates and training for the Springfield Police Department. It's good to know that we're going to continuously educate them. And we'll hear more about those efforts coming up later on in this episode when I talk with Chief Paul Williams. And finally, they're going to include sexual assault initiatives in the list of legislative priorities sent to lawmakers in Jefferson City. I feel like that's where we can all participate in the process. We can contact the people in our legislature and let them know how important this is. The reason I wanted to remind you of those recommendations is because Chief Paul Williams is laser focused on them, and I think we should be too.
I'm speaking with Chief Paul Williams from the Springfield Police Department. And I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. I just can't even imagine how crazy things are for you guys right now and the day and age we're living in. And everything going okay, though?
Yeah.
COVID and everything, your troops are dealing with it okay?
Yeah, I was going to say even busier than normal the last 6 or 7 months with COVID and then a couple of very high-profile incidents involving officers. One, we lost an officer. Another one where he's paralyzed for the rest of his life. Those really impact day-to-day officer morale, and then add to that everything else that's going on in society related to law enforcement. But we are blessed to live here in Southwest Missouri, Springfield, Missouri. We're a very supportive community. I think the officers feel that on a daily basis. We'll work through all this and come out better on the other side.
Glad to hear it. Well, let's talk about how much the police department has changed since the time that the CNN article covered, which was over 10 years ago. Just to clarify, the destruction of the rape kits, I just want to get one question about it out of the way. Was that an acceptable procedure at the time?
Sure. So let me start with, you mentioned that CNN article. It's unfortunate that still keeps getting brought up. But we had actually changed our processes and procedures regarding the sexual assault investigations and rape kits years before that reporter started meeting with us. And my intent on doing the interview was to talk about how things used to be. And then how things have changed in a positive way, and really hope that would be the focus. And unfortunately, the reporter chose to not mention any of the changes and made it seem like what she reported on was occurring right now. And that's unfortunate. It's really created, a negative image on the police department, but also on it's harmed our relationship with the public that we work very hard to build and maintain. And so I think we're back. We're getting that back. And I think people understand the facts now. But I appreciate the opportunity to talk once again about that. Now, to answer your specific question, it was kits and how long they were kept and what happened to them was a different time 10, 20, 30 years ago. And the first thing I'll mention is there was really no understanding or no way to link cases together at the time. Evidence gathered in one case is really just linked to that case. So what happened was if there was not going to be any prosecution or when a case was concluded in some way, the prosecutor, the investigator, and the crime lab folks would get together and determine if that evidence A, needed to be tested, or B, should be kept. And if the decision was it didn't need to be kept, then yes, they were destroyed. That was pretty much the national standard practice throughout the country, not unique to us. And dating back that time, you said prior to 10 years ago, and we really changed our practice after I attended some training put on by the ICP through the Violence Against Women Initiative Project that really talked about the best practices we should be following in sexual assault investigations that were just then coming into vogue. And so I brought those back, and we immediately did a review to see if we had any kits on the shelves, if you will. Now we call those the backlog kits. And discovered that we had, and then asked specifically about the when they were disposed of, and discovered that it was up, as I said, that on this three-person committee, if you will, but ultimately left to the investigator, and changed immediately at that time to say, we're not going to destroy any kits unless it's approved by a supervisor, and then ultimately changed that it has to be approved by me as the chief. I think we, as in any other profession, you learn how to do things better. Specifically in our profession, learn how to serve victims better. And we did that, led that effort, certainly in the state of Missouri, but even across the country, we've been at the forefront of making sure that we're doing that better. Technological advances in training, advances in working with victims advocates, and then making sure that everything we do now and have for the last 7 or 8 years has been victim-centered, trauma-informed whenever we're dealing with a sexual assault victim, I think is a good thing.
How do you see the attitudes have changed in your department for sexual assault victims? Has there been a shift that you can put your finger on?
In the department, the opportunity to for people to experience that different aspect of training and how to deal with victims that is really victim-centered, victim-focused, and as I mentioned, trauma-informed, the fact that maybe some of our questioning and techniques would have been had the effect of re-traumatizing victims in the past. And we just don't do that anymore. So I think officers on the street and detectives specifically really have a focus on that. And we learn how to better conduct questioning and interviewing and really providing service to our victims and continue to improve on that each and every day.
What kind of training do you receive on trauma?
So the most recent and will be ongoing training is the forensic experiential trauma-informed training, the FETI training, F-E-T-I is the acronym. It's a great program. And we not only are providing that training to our investigators, we're starting with our sexual assault investigators and expanding it to all victims, person crimes investigators, and eventually, hopefully, throughout the entire department. But we're also opening that up on a regional basis to prosecutors, other area law enforcement agencies. We're going to be hosting that training. The benefit of discussing this issue and getting all the issue of sexual assault in our community brought to light, this is one of those good results that we identified this training. We're able to bring it here. We successfully applied for a grant to provide this training at no cost to everyone who will be attending the training, our folks and people from throughout the area. And along with that, we received funding for two victims advocates, which we've long wanted to have on staff here, basically, to connect with victims specifically of sexual assault and domestic violence early on. They've always had the opportunity to connect with someone from the victim center. They have advocates on call 24 hours a day, but having two people now embedded in the police department, if you will, and available not just on call, but to be involved in any aspect of the investigation. So from the initial interview to doing follow-ups, to really connect with victims early on and give them a face, a name, and a number to talk to. And we're already seeing the benefit. They've been on staff here for about 4 or 5 months, and we're already seeing the benefits. I think that will continue. It's my hope that when the grant expires, that we will identify funding to continue having those positions in the police department.
Yeah, it's crazy how all these things cost money just to give better service to the community. You just find grants then to pay for it when the funds aren't coming from taxes, so to speak. Is that right?
Yeah, we actively seek to partner with our community partners, the Victim Center, Harmony House. For example, we came together along with about 20 other agencies to open up a family justice center. And I know we're talking about sexual assault here, but that's a domestic assault focused facility, but sexual assault is a huge component of that. So they really intertwine. A great example we do here in Springfield, Greene County, we form public-private partnerships. So you have a county providing some funding, you have the city providing some funding, you have all these various entities stepping forward, either providing in-kind contributions or people getting processes together and really working to better serve our victims. Even an entity you might think would be involved, the Springfield Public Schools were involved because they actually had a facility that was vacant. And we approached them, the Family Justice Center, and were able to negotiate a sale of a piece of property for $10 to the county and move the Family Justice Center into, expand the space available, and better serve our victims in a better location. And I think that's just a good example of, you don't just have the tax dollars. It's not just the police department. It's anybody and everybody in the community coming together when they see there's an issue. And we're really going to see the benefit of that moving forward as well.
That's great. Do you have officers like on TV, the Sexual Victims Crime Unit? Do we have a special division within the police department to handle these crimes?
Sure. Within our criminal investigations section, we have a special victims unit, and their focus is on primarily sexual assaults. I will say it's just like TV. I don't think anything's just like TV. But if you're asking if we have an SVU, yes, yeah. We have an SVU.
How many folks are in there?
Focusing on sexual assault, or I can just give you the full unit. There's a sergeant, a corporal, and eight investigators, and they investigate child crimes as well. So it's a... And off the top of my head, I hesitate to say exactly how many of them just investigate sexual assault. It's really more of a sexual victims, meaning there's a broad category there.
Yeah, I'm sure it crosses over quite a bit, too. That's interesting. I didn't realize a lot of what you're saying.
That's right? Good. That's what we're here for. Educate yeah. You, educate the community through your podcast. I think it's a wonderful opportunity for us.
Thank you. Okay, I have pulled up from the website, and part of it's still under construction, it looks like, as far as the standard operating guidelines, but I was able to find the sexual assault investigation standard operating guidelines, and I'm going to encourage people to go to my website or to your website to look at it and check out some of the information in there, but I wanted to point towards a couple of things that I think are really important, such as when somebody's been doing illegal drugs or maybe underage drinking, how do you treat those people? I think that might cause a lot of folks from maybe calling the police if they think that they're going to get in trouble for their drug use, you know?
Okay, I'm confused as how that's related to sexual assaults.
Are
you talking about a victim who may have been using drugs or maybe intoxicated?
Exactly.
Okay. That has absolutely no bearing on the reporting or the investigative process. If someone's a victim of violent crime, their circumstances certainly aren't going to affect how we're going to respond to that. So I would say if someone's concerned about that, they shouldn't be. Now, the fact that someone may have been using drugs, may have been intoxicated, certainly may be an element of the investigation, but that's not a reason not to report and not to come forward to the police department and have us try to help you to not only either find out what happened if you're not aware or identify the person responsible, or more likely help you bring that person to justice if they've committed a violent sexual assault.
Can you give just a brief rundown of how the rape cases are investigated? I know every case is different, but so there's a rape. There's a rape kit. There's an interview. Do those all happen the same way every time, or is there different processes for different situations?
There's a basic process, and you mentioned our website a couple times. We have a whole page, a landing site dedicated to that called Victim Resources on our webpage. And it has all this information you're talking about and a whole lot more. And one of those things that's on there, the investigative process, is delineated for you. But we also created a pamphlet for those that don't have access to the web, a guide to the sexual assault investigative process, and walks you through those basics. So you can walk through that basics if you want. Like I said, every case is a little bit different, but the basics is once someone chooses to file a police report, that's first thing, and that's on the victim. We don't make anybody report. I would encourage people to report. I think nationally, the instance of reporting sexual assaults is about 1 in 6 or 7 of victims actually reports. So there's more out there occurring, unfortunately, than we're aware of. My first thing would be to encourage people to come forward and file a report. If you do that, you can actually request no investigation. If you just want to file the report, but you're unsure, you're uncomfortable, you don't want to go forward at that time, we still take the report, and it will basically be in what we call suspended status, meaning it sits there until you contact us and you want to move forward, or there's other information presented that, that would result in us opening the case back up again. If you choose to go forward, you can delay it or stop it at any time, move forward, and it's a constant contact with the investigator is what we practice to make sure that the victim is fully informed and fully involved in the process throughout. Once the report's filed and you decide you want to process it or you want to proceed with it, any evidence that's collected or discovered certainly is acted upon, physical evidence sent to the crime lab, and then evidence such as witness testimony or surveillance photos, et cetera. It's all part of the investigative process. Now, the investigator gets to a point where they're comfortable that they have enough to present to the Greene County Prosecutor's Office, and then the prosecutor's office decides if a charge is going to be filed or not. That's out of our hands. We also have cases where there's just not enough to pursue at that time. So generally those cases, like those where a victim says they don't want to proceed, we suspend that. And it's basically just sitting there waiting. And if additional information is presented or discovered, or there's a reason to reopen it, then it's reopened. And that can be done there at the request of the investigator or the victim at any point during the process.
How long does it sit there in suspended status? Forever?
The statute of limitations, which it is different for each case, but you say forever, homicide case, absolutely there's a statute of limitations, so it could sit there forever. That's what we call cold cases. Sexual assault, the statute of limitations is different, different victims, different ages, and it's changed over time. We have a spreadsheet on that, a one-page document that the Attorney General's office put together to address all the different changes in the statutes over the years, to look at that and go, okay, what's the statute of limitations related to my case? But generally, it would remain until such time as that statute of limitations is expired. And then possibly as we could pull that off and exceptionally clear that, meaning there's no way to proceed with this in the future. But our practice has been just to leave it suspended indefinitely.
What happens to cases when there's not enough evidence to be prosecuted? That's when it goes into the suspended status. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Can you give me an idea of a percentage? Somebody calls the police, they make a report, they want to go through with the process, they want to get this guy, but there's just not enough evidence to be prosecuted. Does that happen a lot?
Does it happen? Yes. I wouldn't care as a lot or not a lot. That's, as you mentioned before, each case is different. We look at those really on a case by case, and especially sexual assaults. It's a violent, unique, individual based crime that I prefer to look at those on an individual basis. So we certainly report statistics on those that are reported to us, those that are presented to the prosecutor, those where charges are filed, those where arrests are made. And that information is certainly available on our website and through the High Patrol portal, where they track all the crime numbers from around the state. I also encourage you, if you want to follow up with the prosecutor's office, is really the authority on if charges are filed and if they're not, and if there's any type of percentage you're looking at for cases that are investigated and submitted. And I wouldn't really have that information available.
What kind of services? You mentioned you've got the Family Justice Center, which I've heard really great things about. I've heard about a special interviewing room that really they put a lot of thought into the color of the walls and things to help calm a victim down. Can you tell me a little bit about that or any other special services that victims can receive?
Sure. You're talking about services, and I've already mentioned specifically the Family Justice Center, and there's a plethora of services available there, and I really encourage people to reach out if they're in any type of situation that's involving a domestic assault or sexual assault, but also the victim center. Here in town, we have a fantastic victim center. They have a 24-hour crisis response line that you can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at the initial stages, but they also offer a variety of services to victims after the report's filed, during the investigative, and then even maybe the trial process. Harmony House mentioned before, that's specifically related to domestic violence victims. But then our advocates, I mentioned those before. We have two in-house embedded advocates that they're really a great resource to folks. And then working with the prosecutor's office is part of our movement towards making sure that we are victim-centered and trauma-informed when we're interviewing and even speaking with victims. We created the room that you talked about. We took one of our interview rooms, which are traditional cold start. There's a table, a couple chairs, and there's really nothing there that we interview suspects and witnesses. But for victims, especially victims of violent crime, sexual assaults, the idea was come up with what we call a soft interview room. So instead of just that government issued table and chairs. It's furnished with comfortable chairs, couch, table. It's painted in inviting colors. There's paintings on the wall. There's some plants and different lighting. Really, once again, an example of what we do here in Springfield, Greene County was collaboration with the prosecutor's office and some local businesses who donated the furnishings. We utilize that room just for these types of interviews. It's worked very well. I think it gives people a sense of comfort in a very trying time and helps in the interview process as well. So happy for you if you want to take a look at that. I know we posted pictures when it opened up. You can probably get with Jasmine, see if they're still available on our website. Anything positive, we always do a press release. At times, I've heard people say we bombard social media. That's a good thing. And we want people to know when things are happening, especially positive things or changes in our community and our investigative process. It was a great idea and a great concept. And we actually broadened that. And we have one at each of our stations. We have one at headquarters where most of our detectives are, but we converted one of our interview rooms down at our South District station. So if that's a better location, either geographically or for whatever reason, for the investigator to meet with the victim or the witness, we were able to do it on the south side of town too.
Great. Oh, I didn't know we had it more than one place. Awesome. What about when a victim feels unsafe? I mean, they've maybe gone to police when they were told not to. What kind of protection can you provide for victims?
Connecting with those various resources I've talked about already, Victim Center or the Family Justice Center, Harmony House, but also Legal Services of West Missouri and even Division of Family Services if there are children involved. Connecting the resources and availability, and then either through court processes or protective orders or restraining orders, we certainly want to connect victims to whatever services they need to give them that sense of safety and security. I know we've had victims ask, hey, I feel uncomfortable in my house, my apartment. So either relocating them to a safe location, either the shelter, Harmony House. There's a recent law that was passed creating a victim witness protection fund at the state level. So we now have those resources that we can actually relocate someone for a period of time, not like the federal witness relocation program where you're going to change their identity, but keeping them safe. Now, absent that, and those are extreme measures, but simply putting a watch on their house or their location, notifying patrol officer in that area to cruise by whenever they have time. And then certainly if the victims want officers checking in on them when they're available, we've done that in the past as well.
That's good. Can you talk about the Safe Kids Initiative? That's a pretty big deal. I'm really proud of our participation in that.
Sure. So that's a statewide initiative. Actually, it's a nationwide initiative that Missouri was a little late to the game getting involved in, but been very active. I'm actually on the working group that's been working statewide to do a couple things. One, inventory and find out exactly how many backlogged, how many kits were sitting on shelves or evidence rooms in hospitals and sheriff's departments and police departments around the state, and then get those tested, provide funds to get all of those tested. And then three, to create a tracking program to track sexual assault kits, because really there isn't one now. Highway Patrol, DPS provides the kits free of charge to hospitals and police and sheriff's departments. But there's you'd think there'd be a number on them and you could figure out where that kit is in the system. That hadn't been the case. So creating that tracking system moving forward. Pretty pleased with the results so far. I had a conversation this morning with Judge Mickey Keithley Williams, who chairs that group, that we have completed the grant that we were awarded a couple years ago to provide testing. We've tested about 1,500 of the over 6,000 kits that were discovered statewide, and selected a vendor and working towards the tracking program, which I hope will be online next year. And SPD has been at the forefront of that. We were the first agency selected to submit kits as part of the Safe Kit Initiative in the state of Missouri. And they've come back to us twice since then to send additional kits. So our backlog is being reduced that we had. And also one of the first agencies to receive some results. The kits are tested through the grant by a private lab, Bodie Laboratory in Virginia. So they're not adding to the workload of the Highway Patrol Crime Lab here in the state. So they're packaged, they're secured, they're shipped off, and then private lab tests them and gives us the results back through the Attorney General's office. So it's generally about $1,000 to $1,100 a kit to get tested. So that's a considerable expense, but it's provided for by the grant, which is a good thing. And I'm hopeful. I know we applied for another round of funding, a second grant from the DOJ to help us continue that effort. And that application was submitted a month or two ago, waiting to hear back to see if the state of Missouri through the general's office had been approved and if we can be able to continue that process as far as testing the backlog kits.
And that's just for the backlog kits. What's happening with the current
kits? Correct. Yeah. The grants to address the backlog kits, so current kits, and as I mentioned earlier, we have no backlog since 2014, because in 2014, we started sending all of our kits, regardless of what the process had been in the past. They all go to the crime lab for testing. We've been doing that since 2014, and 2 years ago, there was a statewide statutory change, a mandate that all kits have to be submitted for testing. So there is no, we're not adding to the backlog in hospitals or law enforcement agencies. So all the kits are submitted for testing, and then the crime lab for most of us in the states, Missouri Highway Patrol, but there's also a crime lab, Kansas City Police Department, St. Louis Police Department, St. Louis County, and St. Charles Police Departments have their own labs, so they do their own testing. And you put all those together, and the availability of getting kits tested moving forward will continue to be a possibility.
Do you feel like the crime lab is being a little more cooperative now than they used to be and moving those things along?
Well, I think they've always been cooperative. You mentioned earlier, things cost money, so lack of resources and personnel to keep up with what's submitted to them, I think, has been the issue. I actually serve on the Crime Lab Review Commission, have for 4 or 5 years, and traveled all over the state and looked at all the crime labs and met with the directors, and I understand their predicament, that they want to, they just don't have the means to. So I think I was an early proponent of finding a private lab to take some of the heat off and certainly address the backlog. And I think that's a good thing. It's grant funding. I think there's still some funding needed at the state level to enhance the ability of the state crime lab to keep up with what's coming in now and not create a backlog on their part of evidence being able to be tested for a period of time.
Is there any kind of priority on how they're tested, first come, first serve?
Absolutely. So generally, it's first come, first serve. Certain crimes and sexual assaults is one of those. And if you go to the Highway Patrol's crime lab website, they'll tell you the same thing. They prioritize those, but agencies can speak up and notify them and say, we want these things tested first as far as what we've submitted. And that's a regular ongoing process, and they are very quick to adhere to our request to prioritize sexual assault kits.
Interesting. Is there anything you've discovered since those kits have all, I know the backlog kits, there was some story that came out that I think many of them were serial rapists. Is there anything that we've learned from all of this in testing the kits?
So on the backlog kits, and specifically those that are tested regarding the grant, there's a requirement in the grant that all of those positive kits, or when there's someone's identified, they have to be entered in the National CODIS database. Now, there's a reason for that, because even if a case can't be prosecuted in one community or one part of the country, if that person is a predator and as you mentioned, a serial rapist and committed crimes in their community, that may be the link to providing that information to identify that person. And that's what's happening with the backlog kits. There have been some nationwide, there's certainly been people identified that have been brought to justice who were committing acts across multiple jurisdictions. We're starting to receive some of our test results back. We did have some positive hits. They've been entered into CODIS, and we are actively investigating those cases now.
How are you able to track all of this information? Because it is confusing. If someone doesn't report a rape, there's still a rape, you can't track it. I saw that last year the rapes rose by nearly 7% in Springfield. Do you think that's a good thing because people are reporting more? What do you think about that?
So as far as reporting and tracking, we track everything. So the report's tracked, it's identified, the kits are tracked. In fact, when the task force met with our investigators and our evidence room personnel, they used us as a template of how to create the tracking system throughout the state, because we could identify all the kits that we had and all the evidence in the cases and the victims and where the case was. So that's a good thing that we're able to track now.
Yeah.
And I think it'll be even better. We've been able to track, but maybe victims haven't been able to. After the local sexual assault task force met and some recommendations came out of that, we created a hotline. Actually, we we worked with the victim center, utilized their existing hotline and added something to that. If you were the victim of a sexual assault, whether you reported it or not, and you'd like to contact the police department, or you think you might want to report it, but you're not comfortable contacting the police, you contact the victim center on their 24-hour hotline, ask questions about a current or past case or something you want to report. And if you don't feel comfortable going to the police department, the victim center advocates will come to us for you. So trying to offer one more option for folks that don't know, or maybe they did report and don't know what happened to their case years ago, we can track that down for them. And if they didn't report it and they want to now, we can certainly walk them through that process. So I think that's all very, very positive from a victim standpoint, providing different avenues for victims to contact us and not just saying you need to call the police department or we can't do anything about it. As far as your, I think you mentioned the increase in reported rapes last year, about 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 rapes, sexual assaults are reported nationally. I don't think this community is any different. I would take that to mean the increased public awareness through our efforts, through the Sexual Assault Task Force, through our local Me Too group, is really bringing awareness to the problem and encouraging people to come forward, and the police will help them if they've been a victim. I like to think that's what's led to the increase in the reported rapes. I don't think it's an actual increase in the occurrence of sexual assault. But more people feeling comfortable coming forward and letting us investigate and try to bring that perpetrator to justice.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's probably the case. I hope it is. Anyway.
Yeah.
Is there anything that the sexual assault force may have missed that you wish could have been covered? Or if you had a magic wand or could create a law or something like that, is there anything that you would fix?
I think the Sexual Assault Task Force did a great job. They really reached out and had a broad reach into the community. The makeup itself of the group was pretty broad. And they used my office, my staff, as a resource to provide information as they went about their business. And I think their recommendations were certainly on track, intentioned, and dealt with the issue as a whole. If you've read their recommendations, they're really community-based. It was about education and awareness. It was about community criminal justice, systemic changes and training. And then the police were certainly involved in that. The results of their work did not indicate that it was a police-only issue. It's really a community-wide issue. I really appreciated that, the way they went about that. And I think we need to continue that effort to educate and bring awareness to this issue in our community. And we use this in a lot of things, but the common phrase of see something, say something, and it really takes all of us to step up. And if you see something out of the ordinary, to say something. And it's really incumbent upon every citizen here in Springfield and Greene County to take that to heart, especially in relation to sexual assault. And you can't just say if the victim doesn't say anything, then we shouldn't do anything. No, some people need that help and need that support in order to be able to come forward and report and then support them through the process. The recommendations were in the report went to City Council, and I think it was in a City Council subcommittee that's looking at a report now a year later on where we're at on those recommendations. So looking forward to seeing what that brings.
Do you think that there's enough tough sentences for rapists? Do you think that's something maybe we could work on?
You know, outside the police department's purview, I think any person convicted of a violent crime needs to go to prison and needs to go to prison for a long time. I'm probably not the right person to ask that question.
I just thought I'd try. To me, I feel like that's the biggest hole. After me going through everything, all of the reports from the meetings and all of my research, I feel like that is the biggest part that we could improve on. You said there was a judge in one of your groups. And so do you work with the justice? You work with the Department of Justice. Do you work with any of the judges at all in any of these groups that you're a member of?
The working group for the Attorney General's Safe Kit Initiative, that's chaired by a retired judge, Mickey Keithley Williams. And she does a fantastic job in keeping us on track and moving towards really administering the grant funds properly. But as far as judicial involvement, the local sexual assault task force recommendation included some provisions for working on other aspects of the criminal justice system through the judicial process. I think there was a recommendation for some training, much like we've talked about the FETI training, making sure that our investigations are victim-centered and trauma-informed. I think that needs to be extended to all aspects of the criminal justice system, our prosecutors, our public defenders, our defense attorneys, and the judges themselves, to make sure that everything they're doing as they conduct those hearings, that trial, and that culmination of the process, that it is victim-centered and trauma-informed. And I'll echo your comment earlier, that's probably something that hasn't been the case in the past, and would look for some involvement of all aspects of the criminal justice system in addressing this issue.
I agree. I think I'm going to end it there. And is there anything that you would like to add, though? Anything else you want to communicate with our community?
Just, I mentioned earlier, but I just want to emphasize, we provide a lot of information to our citizens, and it's easily accessible. We've talked about the website a lot. We haven't talked about, there's a state law that went into effect in August of this year, establishing a sexual assault survivor's rights. And there's a guide to those rights. It's actually 18 pages. It's called A Brief Guide, but it's very detailed. It's very specific. Put that on our website. We also printed up hard copy booklets of that. If anybody wants that, just let us know. And that's something that we'll be working with the hospitals, the prosecutor's office, making sure all victims who come forward are advised of that throughout the process, and make sure they're aware of what their rights are and what they can expect throughout the process. And then lastly, if you come forward and you work with us, we will do everything in our power to bring you justice and make you feel cared for and supported throughout the process.
That's what we want to hear. Thanks, Chief.
All right. Thank you, Julie. Thanks for calling.
You've been hearing us talk a lot about the Family Justice Center. Well, on the final episode of Rape the Podcast, I'll talk with Jamie Willis of the Greene County Family Justice Center, talking about sexual violence and rape can certainly be triggering, even if we're just talking about the systemic problems and solutions that we're trying to come up with. If you feel like you need some support, if you're feeling a little nervous about what tricks your mind's going to play on you in the next few hours after listening to this podcast or anyone talk about this subject, know that there's always people ready to talk to you. 1-800-656-HOPE. And that's RAIN. .org. RAIN with two N's. Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Ballou, and this is Rape the Podcast.